Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about Yemen. The United Nations calls the nation the world's biggest humanitarian crisis, in which millions are in peril of starvation and disease, both the result of a violent civil war. The United States is involved in what is by and large a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. The U.S. is sharing intelligence and refueling Saudi coalition planes carrying out airstrikes. The U.S. also has carried out drone strikes against Iran-backed Houthi fighter camps. Coming up, we'll hear from a former ambassador to the war-torn country and a foreign relations expert on the region. Joining us now is Reuters correspondent covering the Arabian Peninsula, Noah Browning. Welcome, Noah.
Thank you for having me.
What are the interests of Iran and Saudi Arabia in this country? Why is it being called a proxy war?
Well, the two great powers of the Middle East are fighting for influence in all the countries of the region that are suffering through political tensions and wars. It just so happens that the very impoverished and very heavily armed country of Yemen is the latest state to join that unfortunate club. And by virtue of it being next to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia believes it has a strong stake in what happens there. But because of the fact that a Shiite militant group is the party that took over the country in 2014, Iran believes that it has an easy vehicle to influence there and a kind of easy way to get at its main rival, Saudi Arabia, which is a Sunni kingdom.
Where did the Houthis come from? What do they want?
That's a very important question and a tricky one. The Houthis spent most of their existence over the last 15 years or so as a very obscure group that dedicated itself to preaching and kind of religious revivalism in a very rural part of northern Yemen. They weren't much to speak of. Very few people in the Arab world, and especially outside of it, gave them much mind. But I think in this climate, aggravated by the wars in Iraq and Syria, their religious military message became very strong in the country and gained more currency and became more alarming to their neighbors.
You know, when I read about them, it seemed like they had more to do with peace, spreading of peace, than spreading of violence. When did they become militarized?
Well, I suppose every political group needs to package their message in those terms. They spoke for most of their existence about renewing Islamic faith and reforming the country. But all along, they were armed. And I think they viewed that message as a convenient vehicle for them to gain more power, not just in their heartland, in these rural northern areas of Yemen, but as we've seen from their actions across the country. And it seems that they've used their message and their arms to spread out. And they've much aggravated Saudi Arabia and their allies in the West by doing this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking about Yemen and the state of affairs in this war-torn country with Noah Browning. He's a Reuters correspondent covering the Arabian Peninsula. He's based right now in Dubai. Coming up, we'll be talking to a former ambassador to Yemen, U.S. ambassador to Yemen, and other experts. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. The Trump administration did not reverse the course taken by the Obama administration in aiding the Saudi coalition. But in recent days, the White House has asked Saudi Arabia to loosen the reins to allow more flow of aid to millions who are starving there. What changed?
The change of heart is intriguing. I think given that the situation in Yemen, which has now become the world's worst humanitarian crisis, is in fact reaching the attention of a lot of news consumers in the West and throughout the world, and given that the United States' role in refueling Saudi planes, providing the bombs that are responsible for these thousands of airstrikes there, is an extreme PR and diplomatic liability for the country. And even for an administration as hawkish as Trump's, it seems that the returns for this in terms of U.S. foreign policy are quite slim in comparison with the suffering that it's wreaking and the damage it's doing to the U.S. image. So I think as the war continues for years and years, something's got to give. At least there could be a Saudi victory, but that seems very distant. So I think that they want to advocate that wiser heads prevail and that they find a different route to conclude this war.
Does a distant Saudi victory suggest a possible Iranian victory?
Well, I think that neither side will prevail on the battlefield. Yemen is extremely divided internally. There are a lot of festering disputes within the country that have been going on for decades. The geography is extremely difficult. I don't think either side, the Iranian-backed or the Saudi-backed, will have a decisive victory on the battlefield. And I think, given that situation, the ultimate losers, as has been the case throughout the war, will be the Yemeni people, who have very little to gain politically or in terms of their own development in this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson a few days ago advised the Saudi kingdom to be a, and this is a quote, a bit more measured and, quote, thoughtful in its actions in the Middle East. What are his concerns about the Saudi approach?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia has been leading some very risky diplomatic maneuvers in the region and in Yemen in the last months. Maybe your listeners will remember that there was a big brouhaha in Lebanon over the resignation of the Saudi-backed prime minister there. That appeared to be a gamble that didn't pay off for Saudi Arabia. It seems that countries in the region and U.S. close ally France weighed in on that crisis and reversed the Saudi policy. And also there's been a diplomatic tussle raging between Saudi Arabia and its neighbor Qatar that I think the U.S. is also very concerned about. It doesn't seem like Saudi Arabia maybe has the diplomatic finesse to see its desires in the region carried through to a positive result for itself and for the United States, that I think that they would prefer that these big, bold moves that Saudi Arabia views as decisiveness in the face of Iran would be taken more slowly and with more consultation with the United States.
Let's talk about the humanitarian crisis, Noah Browning. How long has this been going on and how many people are affected?
Well, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is just ghastly. This is one of the poorest countries in the entire world. Definitely the poorest country in the otherwise quite rich, oil-blessed countries of the Arabian Peninsula. There are about 28 million people in Yemen, most of whom were very poor and bad off even without the civil war raging there, that now that it's been progressing for nearly 3 years, something like four-fifths of the country rely on some form of humanitarian aid, whether it's a food handout or medicine provided by the UN or other international organizations to even get their meals and ward off disease. And there's been a big outbreak of diseases that were widely eradicated in the West, like cholera and diphtheria, creeping up in the country again.
The last I read about this, about 10,000 people have died?
I would say that number is a gross underestimation. That figure is from the UN. It's about a year or so old, and it only reflects combat deaths, people who were shot or killed in a bombing. The number of people who have been affected by starvation and disease is perhaps many thousands, if not tens of thousands, higher.
And I also read that somewhere between 7 and 8 million people are at risk of starvation at this point.
The situation now is so catastrophic that there are no parallels on the whole face of the globe to what's going on, which makes it so much more tragic that there appears to be no political solution around the corner to get this many tens of millions of people out of this nightmare.
What does the food issue, the starvation and the disease issue have to do with Saudi Arabia blocking humanitarian aid?
It has almost everything to do with that. Saudi Arabia has imposed a blockade over the entire country that it says is aimed at preventing Iranian weapons from reaching the Houthi group that it's at war with. But UN experts and aid groups are saying that this blockade, which includes airspace, things like commercial flights, but also crucially cargo shipments by sea, is preventing the normal flow of food and fuel that normal people in Yemen depend on for food that would appear on their table every day.
Are there any non-governmental organizations operating in Yemen right now to try to help?
Well, almost every non-governmental organization is operating in Yemen right now. But the problem is they have so many issues with access in terms of this blockade and getting food and medicine in that they are having a very hard time actually providing for people.
A resolution is pending in the House that would call for the invocation of the War Powers Act to end U.S. participation in the war in Yemen. Under what auspices is the U.S. operating now in aiding the Saudi coalition?
Well, I believe that in a situation like with Vietnam, this is a very tricky U.S. military entanglement that is not formally declared as a war. Obviously, the participation of the United States is much more indirect in this case. They provide intelligence, they provide aerial refueling, they provide weapons, but there's no declared war, and there are no boots on the ground, at least in numbers of hundreds or you know, facing down the enemy on the battlefield. But I think as the situation progresses for almost 3 years now, and thousands of U.S. bombs have been dropped on this country, then many observers are wondering how much longer the United States should be committed to this conflict.
Ali Abdullah Saleh, a longtime leader of the country and in recent years a behind-the-scenes activist switching sides when convenient, he was killed last week. The details are unclear. Maybe they're clearer now. It was kind of murky at the time. What are the implications of his death at this point, Noah?
Well, this was just a giant event. This is one of these unstoppable strongmen of the Middle East in the kind of mold of Gaddafi or Saddam, who met the same end as those other two. Few people in Yemen thought a person this huge in the country could die, but it seems that the alliance he had with the Houthi group against Saudi Arabia quickly collapsed. He was killed very dramatically, and his body was exhibited on video by the Houthis. And the hope of the Saudis now is that his loyalists will be very upset by this graphic murder of their leader on camera, and that they might subtly switch sides against the Houthis and advance the Saudi line in the war.
Well, so who are his, what is his group? He was working with the Houthis at a certain point, then just recently switched sides again. Where are his people at this point?
Well, obviously the politics in Yemen are very complicated, but long story short, Saleh as president for almost a third of a century, built up the entire Yemeni state, institutions, ministries, and especially the military all around his person. Especially in the army, he put key relatives in charge of important positions. These are people who fought on the front lines, got other allies who are technocrats and knew how to run the country, and his whole ruling party were dedicated to him personally. With him gone, these people are going to be extremely disgruntled. They're very important people in terms of administering the country and in fighting the war against the Saudis. If it seems that they're so upset by his death at the hands of the Houthis that they might change sides, this could be a turning point in the war.
Noah Browning, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Noah Browning is a Reuters correspondent covering the Arabian Peninsula. We've been talking to him by phone from Dubai. Coming up, we're going to hear from a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen and a couple of experts on the region. If you have a question or comment about the conflict in Yemen, about the U.S. role in that conflict as an ally to the Saudi Arabia forces, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the civil war in Yemen and the resulting humanitarian crisis there that threatens the lives of some 7 million people right now. We just heard from a Reuters correspondent covering the Arabian Peninsula. We turn now to the deeper story of Yemen and the options going forward. Joining us is Ohio State political scientist and affiliate of the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies, Alexander Thompson. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And by phone, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, Adam Barron, who is based in was based in Yemen from 2011 to 2014 as a journalist, now based in Beirut. Welcome, Adam.
Good to be here.
Also by phone, retired U.S. ambassador to Yemen from 2010 to 2013 and now director of the Center for Gulf Affairs at the Middle East Institute, Gerald Feierstein. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Pleasure to be with you.
Ambassador, what are the U.S. interests in Yemen? How do U.S. politicians, how does the military explain our presence there?
Well, I think that we have several enduring interests in Yemen. First, of course, is the fight against violent extremism, and in particular, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which has been a source of several of the most recent most serious plans for terrorist attacks here in the United States in 2009 and 2010, and that continues to be an extremist force that is concerning to the United States and to the world for security. The other issue, of course, is that Yemen occupies a strategic location in the Arabian Peninsula. It is, of course, in the area of the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb, which is a potential chokehold for a great percentage of international shipping that passes between Asia and the West, and also, of course, just across from the Horn of Africa, which is another area of concern for the United States. The interest or the ability of Iran to establish a foothold in Yemen and potentially threaten the Bab el-Mandeb, as well as the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf, would be seriously concerning for the U.S. in terms of maritime security.
We just heard from Noah Browning of Reuters, who said that neither side looks like they're going to prevail, even in the long term. Is Yemen just going to be a punching bag for these powers at this point?
Well, I think he's absolutely right that at this point the situation appears stalemated. There's not a clear path forward for either side. The important thing to remember about the Yemen conflict is one that's sometimes lost on the larger public is that this is really a Yemen civil war. It's not a Saudi-Yemen war. It's not a Saudi-Iranian proxy war. This is an internal dispute among factions within Yemen. And ultimately, the solution to the conflict is going to be a solution that the Yemenis find themselves. So far, it's looking not very promising that we're getting any closer to that solution.
Adam Barron, you know, says, you know, several accounts, I've mentioned it earlier in the program, described the war as a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Ambassador just said that's not really the case. You've written that Yemen has its own domestic logic, I think was the phrase you used, one independent of the Saudi-Iranian situation. Can you flesh that out a little bit for us?
And I mean, we'll take the example of the Houthis. The Houthis are a militia group that obviously has ties to Iran and is receiving Iranian support, both on a political and financial and, in some cases, weapons level. That being said, when you look at how the Houthis are acting, in a lot of regards, this is much more to do with domestic politics. When you look at why people are supporting the Houthis, reasons for their growth, this is something that is very much domestically rooted. And I think that goes with a lot of the groups that are tied with the Saudis as well. I was in Madad approximately two months ago, which is an area where there's where effectively the Saudis have succeeded in kicking the Houthis out. And now you had a lot of people backed by the Saudis fighting the Houthis. In this case, these people weren't fighting the Houthis because the Saudis were paying them. They were fighting the Houthis because for their own locally rooted Yemeni issues, they didn't want the Houthis ruling over them. And I think a lot of this nuance is lost because it's much easier to say oh, you know, there's this Yemen versus Saudi Arabia, excuse me, Iran versus Saudi Arabia proxy war in Yemen, than going in and dealing with the very complicated nuances of this conflict.
But if Saudi Arabia and Iran weren't involved in this, if they just let Yemen do, you know, duke it out among themselves, would it change anything?
Oh, I mean, that's an interesting hypothetical. I think if Iran and Saudi Arabia were not, you know, involved, to some extent, the argument could be made that it would be a conflict that's easier to be solved. But, you know, I mean, there's the comparison that's often made to the Yemen's civil war in the 1960s, which itself was partially something with domestic logic, but had the involvement of, you know, Saudi Arabia and the UK on one side, Gamal Abdel Nasser backing the Republicans. And that was a conflict where once you had the foreign influence really decreased, it was solved. It petered out. It began to peter out, and the intensity of the war really decreased. But that being said, you know, in a lot of ways, this was a war that was quite brutal, and it was a conflict that was certainly taking place long before you had these foreign powers really enter in a major way. If you look 2012, 2013, 2014, the Houthis were clashing with their various domestic enemies, you know, in numerous Yemeni provinces. We're talking the province of Saada, Hadja, Amran, Al-Juf, etc. So I think there is the case to be made that even if, you know, you had, this was purely a 100% Yemeni conflict, there would still be fighting. Although, obviously, I think it would most likely be the case that the fighting would be far less severe.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the civil war in Yemen. It's a country of about 27, 28 million people. At the very lowest range of estimates, 10,000 have died in this war. Millions, as many as 7 million, are doomed to starvation if something doesn't change very, very quickly. You just heard from Adam Barron. He's a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He was based in Yemen from 2011 to 2014. He's now in Beirut. Also with us is Ambassador Gerald Feierstein. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen from 2010 to 2013. He's now Director of the Center for Gulf Affairs at the Middle East Institute. And also with us, Alexander Thompson, political scientist at Ohio State and an affiliate at the OSU Mersheim Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State. Alexander, Yemen was a part of a region colonized by the British, but the country had been divided for years, for hundreds of years, by religious sects. Why all the infighting over the years, and does the colonization have anything to do with it?
Well, I should probably defer to the other guests on the actual sort of history of Yemen and the internal politics of Yemen. But, you know, I think what we've seen over the last, especially since the end of the Cold War, is that in a number of countries in the Middle East, we're seeing that the boundaries were really artificially created at the end of the colonial period. And in some ways, we're still working out some of the consequences of those artificial boundaries today.
So then, Ambassador Feierstein, did Yemen exist before the Cold War in and of itself?
Well, Yemen is actually one of the oldest nation states in the Arabian Peninsula, going back to the Queen of Sheba and even before that. So yes. The country existed in two. There were actually two Yemeni states. There was North Yemen, and Adam referred to the conflict between the Imamate and the Republic in the late 1950s, early 1960s, that eventually established the Republic in the North. And then in the South, you had a British protectorate in Aden and a number of principalities in the South. That continued as an independent state after the British withdrew in 1967, and then existed as an independent state until it joined with the North in 1990. So you've had a long history of independence for Yemen, except for that British protectorate. Yemen was never really colonized, and Yemenis are very proud of the fact that they were never a colony of any other state. And there is a Yemeni national identity, even though their political history is complicated.
Adam Barron, the current civil war ignited in 2015 in the aftermath of the so-called Arab Spring of 2011. A lot of people, particularly in the United States, thought, well, wasn't Yemen the one that made it through the Arab Spring, that succeeded where so many others failed in rebelling against their autocratic leadership? What triggered this very current conflict? Was who died or who crossed a line?
Well, I mean, that's it's a very complicated answer to that question. On the one hand, when you look at the immediate trigger of this conflict, it was actually something as boring as the removal of fuel subsidies. Okay. So the Houthis took advantage of widespread discontent over the removal of fuel subsidies and basically turned popular protests, which in part they had fomented with the aid of the now late Ali Abdullah Saleh, took advantage of these protests and used it as a cover to take over the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, which I guess shows the importance of economics. But I think there's two larger issues that sort of fueled this conflict, perhaps three. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, when you have the transitional period, this wasn't as much resolving the issues that led to Yemen's 2011 uprising, let alone the pre-existing issues in the country. And when we talk about that, we're talking about the secessionist insurgency in the south, the Houthi insurgencies in the north themselves, and the political divisions between Yemen's establishment. That basically created a pause. It didn't really create a clear solution, even though there was steps made. If you talk about the national dialogue, the constitution, there was progress. So that's on the one hand. On the secondary hand, a huge amount of focus was placed on what was going on in Sana'a, and I think to some extent, things on the rest of the country kind of progressed on their own. So you had, the Houthis bearing down on Sana'a, for example, and these series of clashes across the country as the Houthis, or across the north of the country as the Houthis did this. Finally, you have the issue of mounting kind of discontent due to the failure of the Yemeni economy, which led to widespread discontent that the Houthis managed to hijack. And then I guess on top of all of this, you had a man, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was effectively deposed in name, but in reality was almost as powerful as ever, continued to lead Yemen's most powerful party, had an unconditional immunity, so he could effectively, do whatever he wanted without any major fear of repercussions. And then finally, so you had this weird situation where he had him team up with his former enemies, the Houthis, in a way to push back and get back some of his power. It's in a lot of ways, as I said before, this is something with its own very complicated domestic logic. And you'll notice that the words Saudi Arabia and Iran never came up in that description whatsoever.
Right.
Which I think is telling.
Yeah. We've already talked about the recent death of Ali Abdullah Saleh. He struggled to modernize the country in his image, as been pointed out in the past. It's one way I heard it described, at least that way, in his image for some four decades or so. Ambassador Feierstein, why the struggle? Is it a corruption issue? Is it because there's so many different factions in such a very small country?
Why the struggle? You mean the current civil war?
To modernize the country. To modernize the country. To create some kind of stable economy.
I think, unfortunately, Ali Abdullah Saleh, like Muammar Gaddafi, like some of the other leaders, really never invested in building a nation state. In other words, the Republic of Yemen was established in 1962, mm-hmm. Following the collapse of the Imamate. The Imamate was never interested in the development of the country. The Republic came in, you had a long history of political upheaval, chaos, assassination of various leaders until Saleh came to power in 1978. Saleh, unfortunately, never really invested in the development of the institutional capacity of the country as he might have done. And so you had a society that had in some ways – the facade of a modern state and did not have any of the underlying foundations that would allow it to really establish itself as a modern state. It is particularly in the North a very tribal society, still one where tribal sheikhs and others have a great deal of power and influence, and were able to prevent a lot of the national institutions, to the extent that they existed, of penetrating outside of Sana'a and the other major cities to establish any kind of real governance in the country. In the South, you had a period from 1967 till 1990 where the country was putatively Marxist, heavily dependent on economic support from the former Soviet Union and other East Bloc countries, Cuba, and never really developed any kind of real governing institutions outside of that very rigid Marxist orthodoxy. So you had a lot of different factors and factions that were rivals for power, didn't want to see the development of a strong central government because they would see that as a threat to their own survival and security. And as the situation deteriorated following the Arab Spring, a lot of those forces came back into play and began once again to assert their primacy, and that has prevented really the successful implementation of the agreements of the Arab Spring and anything that would really help Yemen weather the storm.
We'll continue our conversation. You just heard from former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Feierstein. He's now director of the Center for Gulf Affairs at the Middle East Institute. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the civil war in Yemen and the resulting humanitarian crisis there that threatens the lives of some 7 million people right now. Still with us is Adam Barron, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He was based in Yemen from 2011 to 2014 when he worked as a journalist. Also by phone, retired U.S. ambassador to Yemen from 2010 to 2013, and now director of the Center for Gulf Affairs at the Middle East Institute, Gerald Feierstein. Also, OSU political scientist and affiliate of the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies, Alex Thompson. Alex, I want to read an email from a listener, Ali Mohammed. He writes, "The Saudi-led war in Yemen is a local power and control struggle among Yemeni tribal factions like any other war. There is no military solution in Yemen conflict. Congress has the power to stop the human tragedy in Yemen. Firstly, Congress should hold a hearing about the U.S. involvement and the supply of lethal weapons to the Saudis. Secondly, Congress must also act now and stop military sales to the Saudis in light of the indiscriminate bombings of innocent Yemenis by coalition airstrikes. What is the U.S. gaining from killings of women and children?" So let's go straight to U.S. policy in Yemen. What is the policy that's propping this up?
Right. You know, those are excellent questions from your listener. And I think what we do see is, in fact, more resistance to U.S. policy and displeasure with U.S. policy both in Congress and sort of more broadly in public opinion. It's clear that all sides in the conflict have been committing, you know, violations of international humanitarian law, not being targeting civilians. And this includes Saudi Arabia with its bombing campaign, which the United States is supporting pretty robustly. So it's problematic from a humanitarian perspective. But also just in terms of the U.S. pursuing its interests in the region, it's not clear what exactly the strategy is or whether the current policies being pursued are going to serve U.S. interests in the long run. Ambassador Feierstein did a great job of explaining why Yemen is of strategic importance to the United States. But in terms of the specific policy, it's a pretty blunt one, which mostly involves supporting Saudi Arabia in its intervention into the conflict. There are at least two shortcomings of this. One is that the conflict itself is creating conditions that are probably more conducive to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and to ISIS. So it may be a sort of creating a void that allows them to thrive, which, of course, would go against other interests of the United States. And also, as your listener noted in the email, this is a conflict or a crisis that really requires a diplomatic and a political solution. And it's not
versus
clear.
Versus military, yeah.
Versus military. And the U.S. approach has been pretty blunt relative to those sort of delicate political and diplomatic needs.
Ambassador Feierstein, in terms of policy, I've read that you believe that the U.S. should continue to provide logistical and intelligence sharing support to the Saudi-led coalition.
Yes.
But what about the drone support and refueling for airstrikes and that kind of thing?
Well, the drones are pretty specifically related to the fight against violent extremism and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. We're not... outside of the support that we provide to the Saudi-led coalition, the United States is not involved in the civil war aspects. But we are concerned, of course, about the growth of al-Qaeda, the ability of al-Qaeda to resurrect its position, a lot of which was lost in the 2012-2013 period. I do support the continued policy of assistance to Saudi Arabia. I think that leaving aside without attempting to justify or defend some of the aspects of the Saudi-led campaign, which are concerning to all of us, I think it's important to remember that the Saudi effort is, in fact, in support of the international position on the Yemen conflict, as expressed in UN Security Council Resolution 2216, that the Saudis do support a political resolution of the conflict, as does the United States, and they have supported the efforts of the United Nations to promote dialogue and negotiation among the parties. The main obstacle to a political negotiation and a political resolution of the conflict is the Houthis. It's not Saudi Arabia. We've had three rounds of diplomatic negotiations led by the United Nations with the full support of the United States and the U.S. government, none of which have succeeded, primarily because the Houthis have maximalist demands that are simply not acceptable to the vast majority of the Yemeni people or to the other political factions. We continue to support, and Ambassador Tuller, my successor in Yemen, is still engaged and still working very hard with the Yemeni parties as well as with the United Nations to try to advance the diplomatic effort to resolve this conflict politically. And we'll continue to do that. In the Obama administration, Secretary Kerry was directly involved. I think, and I've said in other fora, that I think that Secretary Tillerson should also become more directly involved in the effort to resolve this conflict. But we need to keep focused on the fact that the Saudis have been very clear, the coalition's been very clear, the government has been very clear in saying that they would participate in and welcome a political resolution. The obstacle right now is the Houthis.
Adam Barron, from where you sit, what do you think about the U.S. role in Yemen? Adam Barron? Okay, we're going to check on Adam Barron. He's visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He was based in Yemen from 2011 to 2014. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Is there such a thing as the Saudi Arabian army? And I understand that that there is not one. And if not, why is that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Gerald Feierstein?
Well, to a large extent, of course, the military split initially in 2011, when a large portion of the military supported the Arab Spring forces against Ali Abdullah Saleh, and then split again in 2014-2015 when the situation deteriorated and Saleh joined the Houthis in opposing the government. Many of the military people went home and decided that they were not going to get involved in the conflict. Some units, of course, stayed with Ali Abdullah Saleh and became part of his effort to regain control of Yemen, and some portion of it remained loyal to the government. Over these past 30 months, the Saudi-led coalition, particularly the United Arab Emirates, have been rebuilding the legitimate Yemeni military, and they've made some success. So there are some tens of thousands of men under arms fighting on behalf of the government of Yemen, but it is still very much a work in progress.
Yeah, Alexander Thompson?
Well, I don't have anything to add to that description, but I do want to go back to something that was mentioned earlier, which was, you know, I think we've gotten a little bit away from the humanitarian crisis and the situation in that regard. And, you know, the one of the problems with Yemen, in addition to the fact that it was already a very poor country, is that it's highly dependent on imports of food and medicine. So when Saudi Arabia started blockading the ports, this had a immediate and profound effect on the ability of international aid agencies to deliver aid. And keep in mind that this is one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in the world, but it also has the distinction of being almost 100% man-made. So this is really a man-made catastrophe where you have poverty with conflict layered on top of poverty, and now cholera outbreaks, which are largely the result of that conflict, which has you know, destroyed infrastructure and reduced access to clean water and sanitation. So you really have these layers and layers of problems, but which are all man-made in one way or another.
You know, Alex, we're really familiar with hearing about the refugee crisis, you know, that created by the conflict in Syria and those kind of things. People escaping that country and going somewhere else in order to survive. Why haven't we heard stories like that about Yemen and the people in Yemen leaving to save themselves?
Right. So, I mean, part of that is just geography, where you're surrounded by water. And then, of course, Yemen also borders with Saudi Arabia. So the borders are controlled in a way that they wouldn't be in some other humanitarian crises, which is a really interesting point, because what it means is that for the victims of the conflict to be assisted, they have to be assisted inside the country. So there are about 3 million internally displaced people. So there are a lot of displaced people. They're just not international refugees. So that's the struggle right now, is to figure out how the aid can get into Yemen and then, of course, distributed to the people who need it.
Yeah, and Adam Barron, I'm sorry we lost you earlier, but I asked about the U.S. role in Yemen and in this conflict? What should it be, the official role, the policy going forward? What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, in a lot of ways, I think what you can call the Riyadh-Washington axis is going to be quite crucial in terms of bringing this conflict to some sort of conclusion. And I think one thing you've seen, and partly this is just due to a bandwidth issue with so many conflicts in the region, and this isn't just something with the United States, but Yemen has been very much on the back burner. And I think that's something that if you are going to see a resolution to this conflict, it's going to have to change. What you need is a more active diplomacy and more active U.S. leadership on Yemen all the way to the top. To some extent, we did see this from Secretary Kerry in the final days of the Obama administration. But the issue is, on the one hand, perhaps you could say it was a little too late for that, and particularly the timing was just not right. It was during the lame duck period. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew that regardless of whether they're negotiating with Kerry and reaching agreements, it's amenable to the U.S. at that point. There was going to be a new sheriff in town soon. Mm-hmm. So I think, in a lot of ways, Kerry's diplomacy does represent a potential model for potential U.S. efforts moving forward.
The Trump administration has not made any big course changes from the Obama administration, but the White House has asked Saudi Arabia to kind of change its approach, allow more flow of aid. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson a few days ago advised the Saudi kingdom to be a bit more measured and thoughtful in its actions in the Middle East. Ambassador Feierstein, I mean, is that too little too late at this point, or is it the beginning of a change? What about putting Yemen on the front burner? Is that possible?
Well, I think it is significant that the U.S. did take that position. What had happened was that the flow of humanitarian assistance into Yemen was difficult. But it was functioning to a certain extent. In early November, there was a missile strike launched from Yemen towards Riyadh. It didn't hit its target. It was taken out by Patriot missiles. But in any event, the Saudi reaction was to really put in a full blockade of assistance or of any shipping going into Yemeni ports, and I think that made a difficult situation much worse. And the U.S. was responding to that, I think, and basically Secretary Tillerson saying that they really needed to back off and allow the aid shipments to resume, which I think was the right position. I do think that the international community should be doing as much as possible to assist the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Yemen. A lot of the problem does rest in the ability of shipping to come into Yemeni ports, but there's also a big problem with internal distribution once the shipments arrive. And that is the responsibility of both parties in the conflict. They have not really been very permissive in allowing shipments to get distributed without any kind of restriction based on political issues. And the ultimate reality is that we're not going to resolve the humanitarian situation until there's a political solution.
Ambassador Feierstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
Gerald Feierstein, retired U.S. ambassador to Yemen. Also, Adam Barron, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks to you, Adam Barron, and Alex Thompson of Ohio State, where he is an affiliate of the Mershon Center for the International Security Studies. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.